Good morning. This is the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. I'm Bob Martin. We're here again reading from this week's Independent, dated Wednesday, October 31st, 2018. We start with the feature story, The Case Against Marcy's Law. The proposed victim's right amendment is more complicated than you've been led to believe. On November 30th, 1983, Kerry Conley shot and killed his former girlfriend of 3 years, Marcy Nicholas, a blonde-haired, blue-eyed senior at the University of California, Santa Barbara. 17 months later, Conley was convicted of second-degree murder and sentenced to life behind bars. Marcy Nicholas was one of 2,640 homicide victims in California in 1983. Most of their names have faded from memory, data points from a comparatively violent era. But 35 years later, Marcy lives on, adorning a wave of criminal justice reform sweeping the country, including potentially North Carolina. The roots of Marcy's Law, however, lie less in the 21-year-old's murder than in an incident that happened about a week later. Unbeknownst to Marcy's family, Conley bailed out of jail for $100,000. One day, he ran into Marcy's mother, Marcella Leach, at a grocery store. Leach, who had just come back from a visit to her daughter's grave, was shaken by the encounter. That moment birthed a movement. Marcy's parents came to believe that while criminals had some 20 rights spelled out in the U.S. Constitution, victims and their families had none, not even the right to be told their daughter's killer was walking the streets. They founded a nonprofit called Justice for Homicide Victims, dedicated to righting this perceived imbalance, and pushed for stiffer penalties for convicted felons, including California's controversial three strikes law. In 2008, Marcy's brother, Henry Nicholas III, who helped launch the computer chip manufacturer Broadcom Corporation and who is worth an estimated $3 billion, took up the family's cause, recruiting a team to craft what became Marcy's Law and get it on the California ballot. It passed with 54% of the vote, enshrining it into California law, a mandate that victims should be notified at every step of the justice process, from bail hearings to sentencings to parole proceedings, and that officials must take into account victims' safety when assigning bail or reviewing parole. Nicholas wasn't finished. In 2009, he founded Marcy's Law for All, which aimed to add similar rights to the U.S. Constitution. While that hasn't happened, Nicholas's effort has spread all over the country, to Ohio, Illinois, the Dakotas, and Montana. And on Tuesday's ballot, in Florida, Georgia, Kentucky, Nevada, Oklahoma, and North Carolina. The exact wording varies from state to state, but the general principles are the same. If they desire, victims should be notified of all court proceedings and have the right to speak at hearings involving sentencing or potential release. They should also be notified before a criminal is pardoned or released and afforded privacy from the accused and their attorneys. In addition, the North Carolina version of Marcy's Law effectively expands the number of victims covered under the state's Crime Victims' Rights Act of 1998 to include cases involving juvenile defendants and certain misdemeanors. Proponents say Marcy's Law gives victims a voice in the system that too often ignores them. While crime victims in North Carolina have constitutional rights, including the rights to restitution, to be notified of court proceeding, and to be heard during the trial, they say the state has no process in place to inform the victims of those rights. This amendment bridges that gap, says Francis Battle, executive director of the North Carolina Victim Assistance Network. If it passes, she argues, fewer victims will be blindsided by developments in their cases. Marcy's Law, Battle says, is actually going to require that there are processes in place to ensure that victims do not fall through the cracks, that they are not inadvertently looked over, that they are not forgotten. That's proven to be a compelling sales pitch. Marcy's Law has never failed at the ballot box, and few observers believe it will do so in North Carolina. The proposed amendment offers voters a binary choice. Do you want to protect victims from criminals or not? This was such an apparent no-brainer that when the General Assembly put the proposal on the ballot this summer, only 9 state representatives and 1 senator, all Democrats, voted against it. And even the progressive lobbying voters to nix all 6 amendments have largely avoided discussing this one on its merits. At most, they characterize it as a cynical political ploy or a heavy-handed solution to a problem that doesn't actually exist. But scratch the surface, and the question becomes more complicated. The amendment could have huge ramifications for North Carolina's criminal courts, clogging the justice system and driving up costs. More important, critics say, Marcy's Law will infuse emotion into what is supposedly a fact-based process, allowing victims with financial means to pressure judges to impose higher punishments and, in the process, further exacerbating racial disparities in the justice system. This will distort the system, says Duke University law professor James Coleman. It introduces victims into constitutionally protected proceedings in a way that likely will prejudice the defendant on the basis of factors that will be arbitrary: emotion, wealth, the ability to do it, who can show up at the very last hearing in a case, people who have the flexibility that only money provides. State Representative Nelson Dollar, a Wake County Republican who sponsored the bill, putting Marcy's Law on the ballot, this is a simple and non-controversial idea. The rights guaranteed to victims under the state constitution and state laws are weak and ambiguous. Marcy's Law would clear up any confusion and ensure that victims are taken seriously. The whole point of the justice system is to provide justice for those who have been the victims of crime, Dollar says. That assertion is contrary to law and fact, counters State Representative Marsha Morey, a Durham Democrat and former judge leading the Nix All Six campaign. The system's purpose, she said, is to provide a fair trial for those accused of crimes. The notion that victims deserve rights equal to those of defendants fabricates a false dichotomy, defendants against victims rather than against the state. In terms of the work that police and prosecutors do, they don't do that work for the victims. The victims benefit from it. But they are working for the people of North Carolina, Coleman adds. Like the other amendments, Marcy's Law was placed on the ballot in the wan waning days of the legislative session with little committee and no floor debate. Voters will be presented with a single sentence: constitutional amendment to strengthen protection for victims of crime, to establish certain absolute basic rights for victims, and to ensure the enforcement of those rights. Following an equally anodyne question about whether the state should protect the rights of hunters and fishermen, see the other constitutional amendments on page 12. This is candy for voters, Morey says, designed to both muddle opposition to more controversial amendments like voter ID. Those advocating against all 6 amendments can now be painted as anti-victim and to drive conservatives to the polls. The framing is difficult to disagree with, especially if voters aren't familiar with the fine print. And finding that fine print is difficult. As with other amendments, the General Assembly hasn't written so-called implementing legislation spelling out precisely what the amendment will do. This is just icing on a shallow cake, Murray said. It's deceptive. It sounds good. It's an amendment similar to, do you love mom and apple pie? How can you vote against it? But we don't know what we're getting with this, and it's a get-out-the-vote scheme that actually can do a lot of damage to our criminal justice system. The amendment, critics say, is unnecessary. State law already protects crime victims and funds services to protect them. If there are changes people want to address to our current victims' rights statute, they should be doing that through the law and not through the Constitution, says ACLU of North Carolina Senior Counsel Susanna Birdsong. She calls Marcy's law potentially an empty promise in that lawmakers haven't committed to providing the state the funding that it will require. Indeed, it's not entirely clear how Marcy's law would be implemented or how much it would cost. A June report from the legislature's Fiscal Research Division says the amendment will cost at least $8.8 million in 2021 and $11.2 million a year thereafter, the price of funding 150 victim service providers to notify and coordinate with victims. But even if the state coughs up that money, district attorneys are worried that the amendment's mandates will strain their overburdened F offices, at least according to David Rudolph, a Charlotte-based defense attorney who represented a Durham author, Michael Peterson, and former Carolina Panthers receiver Ray Carruth in high-profile murder trials. The DAs are very, very concerned about it. That Marcy's law will create enormous burdens on the taxpayers of the state for the DA to even begin to comply, Rudolph said. It's hard for DAs right now before an election to come out and say that, but that's the truth. The North Carolina Bar Association says it has no position on Marcy's law, and the director of the North Carolina Conference of District Attorneys did not respond to any request for comment. Neither did Wake County District Attorney Lauren Freeman, who is up for re-election, Durham County District Attorney Roger Eccles, who lost in the May Democratic primary, or Durham County District Attorney-elect Santana DeBerry. Beyond that, the amendment's financial implications are hazy. The RFD report says the impact on the administrative office of the courts is unclear. However, a draft 2017 report from the AOC on an earlier Marcy's Law proposal estimates it would eventually cost $30.5 million a year to hire additional staff. And that doesn't include other costs of implementation. Not only would the law add misdemeanors to the crimes for which victims would receive assistance, thus vastly increasing the number of crimes covered by the law, but it might also lead to longer, more expensive trials, critics say. The amendment supporters say these estimates are inflated. Dollar contends that such a scenario hinges on district attorneys shifting positions that are currently funded by grants onto the state's dime. He doesn't think Marcy's law will cost taxpayers a thing. To the extent that some district attorneys have to perform a little more work is because they are not providing the services and the information to victims that they should have been doing already, Dollar said. If it requires me to do more homework, to do my job the right way, I don't consider that additional workload. I consider that the scope of what our responsibilities are. More important to civil rights advocates than the amendment's fiscal implications, after all, $30.5 million a year is just 0.1% of the state's $239.9 billion budget, it's the way Marcy's law could tilt the scales of justice away from defendants, disrupting a basic philosophical tenet of the justice system that a defendant is presumed innocent and entitled to a fair trial. The problem with including victims as a separate entity in all these difficult stages of the process is that it has potential impacts for the rights of defendants, Birdsong said. For starters, having a victim who is entitled to specific state-sanctioned rights implies that a crime has been committed. But before the state secures a conviction, this crime is merely an allegation. You start off with an allegation. It becomes a crime when it's proven, either because the person admits it or because a fact finder finds it, not because a complainant alleges it, Rudolph said. Is there a presumption that a crime has been committed because somebody's been charged? That's completely inconsistent with the presumption of innocence. What's more, Rudolph continues, allowing victims to influence when hearings take place might conflict with the defendant's right to a speedy trial. For example, defendant's bond hearings could be postponed to a time convenient for the accusers. Suppose a third party says, I'm sorry, I'm going on vacation. I'm going to be out of state for the next couple of months, so we can't proceed with this case, Rudolph said. Does that person have a constitutional right to go take a vacation for 2 months while the defendant sits in jail? And the distinction between the victim and the accused isn't always clear, Rudolph points out. For example, in cases involving domestic violence or self-defense, both parties may allege that the other violated their rights. Designated one as the victim at the outset could bias the case. To State Senator Toby Fitch, a Democrat and former Superior Court judge, the biggest problem with Marcy's law, and the reason he voted against it, is that it allows victims to provide emotional testimony at every step of the process. That, he says, runs counter to the fundamental purpose of the justice system, to assess an allegation based on facts. The state has been able to prove its actual situation based on evidence, not based on sympathy or the lack thereof, he said. A more prominent role for victims might also lead to harsher punishments, Coleman says, especially in cases where victims are articulate and have the means to represent themselves well. Because Marcy's law is law rights are granted upon request and not automatically, he said, the victims who take advantage of them will tend to have money and status, not poor people, who likely are overwhelmingly the majority of victims of crimes in this state. That, in turn, could make the justice system's outcomes even more racially uneven. I think often victims who are black will be ignored in the same way they are ignored today, Coleman said. I think this is going to be a right that will be exercised and implemented for the benefit of white citizens in North Carolina, and that's just a sad fact. Perhaps the best way to evaluate Marcy's law would mean for North Carolina is to look at its effect on the six states that have voted for it. In some, it turns out, the law has produced unforeseen consequences. In South Dakota, which passed Marcy's law in 2016, they spent $500,000 on new staff to coordinate with victims, but officials were nonetheless flooded with paperwork and had to log thousands of calls to notify victims. In some cases, offenders lingered in jail while victims couldn't be notified about bond hearings. The law's privacy provisions also gave the police license to shield information from the public. Almost overnight, vital facts, including crime locations and victims' identity, disappeared from incident logs, according to Megan Raposa, editor of the local newspaper, The Argus Leader. Later, the cops began withholding the names of homicide victims indefinitely. From an open record standpoint, it has tightened the reins, Raposa said. Losing access to some of those specifics just gives us a foggier picture of what's going on. Something similar happened in North Dakota, where police have refused to release the name of a police officer who shot and killed a man and then claimed self-defense, invoking Marcy's law to protect the officer's identity as a crime victim. In Montana, a coalition of newspapers sued over the law, argued that it would make information on crimes became so inaccessible that the media couldn't function. South Dakota lawmakers are now considering asking voters to repeal Marcy's law, or at least its unintended consequences, as they pledge to maintain protections for victims. If that happens, South Dakota will become the second state to pass Marcy law and then roll it back. In Montana last year, the state Supreme Court overturned it before it could be implemented, with the majority ruling that voters should have considered the sweeping changes Marcy law made to the state constitution separately. A federal judge struck down the provisions of California's Marcy's law dealing with parole in 2014, but an appellate court reversed that decision 2 years later. Overall, the law hasn't created an undue burden on the justice system, according to former Judge Paul Cassell, a Marcy's Law advocate. The reports from California are that victims are now treated seriously, that they have rights in the process, and it's improved the quality of justice in California rather than any other way detracted from it. Whatever issues emerge after Marcy's Law passes, North Carolina can deal with them, says Battle of the North Carolina Victims Assistance Network. Certainly there are going to be things that we find out that have to be worked out, she said. There are going to be bugs. There are going to be areas that are going to be improved, potentially some unintended consequences. But that shouldn't stop us from moving forward. We just have to be committed to fixing whatever doesn't work. And right now, what we have doesn't work. Morey counters that there are better ways to accomplish that goal. Funding technology updates and additional staff could enhance victims' notification without compromising the rights of defendants. And rooting the money the state plans to spend on increasing the court system's operational bandwidth directed to victims via the state's existing Victims Compensation Fund, which paid out about $8.7 million in 2017, would be more effective, she said. We need to fully fund the Victims Compensation Fund, Morey said. We need to get services to victims like mental health. Let's not grow a bureaucracy and delay the justice system. On an Inset article, Follow the Money. If people knew the story behind who is pushing what is called Marcy's Law, they would be shocked, says State Representative Marcia Morey, a leader of the Nix All Six effort. All of it is a bit dubious. The person pushing it, California billionaire Henry Nichols III, has spent more than a decade advocating for victims. Twice, however, he's found himself on the other side of the law, as a defendant facing felony charges. This summer, he was arrested in Las Vegas and charged with drug trafficking after police allegedly discovered heroin, methamphetamines, cocaine, and ecstasy in his hotel room. And a decade ago, he was indicted on charges of manipulating stock option grants to enrich his company's employees, trafficking narcotics, and installing a secret and convenient lair in his Laguna Homes Hills home to bring sex workers in. In 2009, a federal judge ruling that the prosecutors had intimidated witnesses threw out the stock-related charges. Prosecutors later dropped the drug charges. Nicholas has spent more than $27 million advocating for Marcy's Law nationwide. In fact, according to the website Ballotpedia, he's contributed at least 90% of the effort's total funding. Nicholas has pledged to spend $5 million in North Carolina. The campaign finance traffic website Open Services show that Marcy's Law for North Carolina has spent more than $235,000 on television ad on just two stations, WCTI-TV in New Bern and WXII in Winston-Salem. The Associated Press reported that the campaign spent another $150,000 on radio ads, and that could be just the tip of the iceberg. I'm afraid a lot of this is about money, political donations going into legislatures to get this passed, dog whistle ads that are on TV, Morey said. We can do anything to strengthen rights to victims throughout statutes tomorrow. If this was such a critically important issue, why hasn't our legislature had more legislation and statutes about victims' rights notification? That was signed from Leigh Taus. And in another Associated article, the other constitutional amendments. In addition to Marcy's Law, there are five other proposed constitutional amendments on the ballot this year. Legislators have not enacted language guiding how these amendments should be put into effect or released estimated costs associated with their passage. Here's what we know about each measure and what we don't. The right to hunt and fish. This amendment would enshrine in the state's constitution a right including the right to use traditional methods to hunt, fish, and harvest wildlife. The amendment doesn't define traditional methods or change existing laws. Opponents believe it's an attempt to drive conservatives to the polls by suggesting their hunting and fishing rights are under attack, when they are not. This also was a worry to the amendment could be used to circumvent environmental protections. Next, the state income tax cap. Currently, personal and corporate income tax rates cannot exceed 10%. This amendment would lower that cap to 7%. To be clear, this is not a tax cut. The individual income rate is currently 5.49%, and the corporate rate is 3%. But opponents say it would prevent the state from raising taxes in the future to pay things like public education and disaster response. To require photo ID to vote. A federal court in 2016 struck down North Carolina's previous voter ID law, finding that it targeted African-American voters. This amendment resurrects the requirement that voters present a photo ID, but legislators won't decide what IDs would be accepted until after votes are cast. Implementing legislation would likely be approved in a lame duck session soon after the election. Proponents say that the measure is necessary to prevent voter fraud, but that doesn't appear to be the real threat. A state audit of the 2016 election found just two cases of impersonation out of 4.8 million vote casts, and only one in which voter ID would have stopped a fraudulent voter. 34 states have some version of the voter ID law, but just two have them in their constitutions. Studies show people of color disproportionately lack IDs, and opponents say securing one would be a barrier for low-income voters and rural voters who live farther away from a DMV office. Next, judicial appointments. Currently, the state constitution gives the governor authority to fill judicial vacancies by appointment. Legislators say this amendment would create a system in which the people of the state nominate individuals to fill vacancies. But really, it just inserts legislators into the process. A commission whose members would be selected by the governor, the General Assembly, and the North Carolina Supreme Court's chief equally would recommend candidates to the General Assembly. Legislatures would then give the governor a list of nominees to choose from. And the governor doesn't pick one of these people in 10 days, the legislature would fill the vacancy. The governor couldn't veto a nominee. This process would apply to seats on the state Supreme Court, the Court of Appeals, and the local trial courts. All five living former governors, Republican Democrats, as well as six former state Supreme Court justices, have come out against this amendment. The State Board of Elections and Ethics Enforcement. This amendment would reduce the number of members on the State Board of Elections and Ethics Enforcement from 9 to 8. Currently, there are 4 Democratic and 4 Republican members each. The 9th is unaffiliated and is nominated by the other 8, with the governor making the appointment. Republicans say the proposed model still gives both parties input and would require the board to come to a consensus. Opponents say it would disenfranchise unaffiliated voters and guarantee gridlock, like the Judicial Appointments Amendment, which is opposed by former governors and justices alike. Now to the news section. Lipstick on a pig. Smithfield will install covers on its hog waste lagoons. Experts say that's not good enough. On Thursday evening, Smithfield Foods announced that it would seal most of its open-air hog waste lagoons and convert the methane its pigs produced to biofuel. In doing so, the world's largest pork producer committed to a course of action that, not so long ago, the industry claimed was expensive and unnecessary. the company patted itself on the back. Our investment in these projects underscores our long-standing commitment to sustainability, as well as our promise to produce good food in a responsible way. That was from Smithfield CEO and President Kenneth Sullivan. The scale of these projects is audacious, but through partnerships with board coalitions and stakeholders, we're confident we can bring about sustainable, revolutionary progress in our effort to minimize our environmental footprint. Hold the applause, environmental experts say. So long as Smithfield Farms persist with an anachronistic lagoon to spray field method of waste disposal, they argue, the threats to water contamination and public health will continue. It is not a solution, absolutely not, says Michelle Nowlin, the supervising attorney for Duke Law's Environmental Law and Policy Clinic. It's an improvement. Anything they do that is beyond a basic hole in the ground and spraying all the manure on the fields is an improvement. Is it sufficient to protect the neighbors and the environment? Absolutely not. North Carolina is home to more than 2,100 hog farms and more than 3,300 lagoons that house about 9 million pigs, which often live in crowded barns. Their feces and urine falls through slats in the ground and is then liquefied and stored in huge open-air ponds nearby. When the lagoons fill up, the liquid waste is released as a mist onto nearby fields. In 2014, more than 500 neighbors of farms that raised Smithfield pigs sued the company, claiming that this system creates a nuisance that infringes on their quality of life. This year, three of those cases have gone to trial in a federal court in Raleigh, and Smithfield lost all three, with verdicts totaling tens of millions of dollars. The remaining cases are now in mediation. Smithfield's announcement comes on the heels of Hurricane Florence in September, which left more than 5,500 hogs dead, three lagoons breached, and 14 lagoons inundated by floodwater. The Chinese-owned conglomerate framed its new initiative as part of a nationwide effort to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 25% by 2025. To do so, 90% of its North Carolina hog farms will be outfitted with manure-to-energy technology. Lagoons will be sealed off, trapping methane that will then be transported to a central processing facility and converted to natural gas. Additionally, Smithfield plans to implement low-trajectory application tools as an alternative to current large-scale spraying that mist hog waste over fields, which plaintiffs in the Newsom lawsuits have complained gets carried by the wind to their homes, and says it will reduce truck traffic, plant more vegetative buffers, and work with universities and other partners to study waste-to-energy technology. It is not clear who will pay for all of this, Smithfield or the farmers with whom it contracts. Smithfield did not respond by press time to the Indy's request for comment. These changes might reduce odors, says Blakely Hildebrand, an attorney with the Southern Environmental Law Center, but they'll do little to improve neighbors' health issues or address water pollution because liquid waste will still be applied to nearby fields and the lagoons, 90% of which lie in the state's flood-prone eastern coastal region, will still be vulnerable to flooding. The lagoon and spray field system is the problem here, Hildebrand says. As long as the lagoon and spray field system is in place, and as long as Smithfield is relying on that system, there will continue to be water pollution issues and environmental justice issues for this industry. Alternatives to the lagoon-to-spray field model have been known for years. In 1999, then-Governor Jim Hunt suggested phasing out lagoons altogether. The next year, Smithfield entered into an agreement with the state attorney general to invest in research on waste management alternatives. As a part of that agreement, researchers at North Carolina State spent years evaluating and identifying environmentally superior technologies. Those technologies went beyond covering lagoons or installing anaerobic digester systems, which convert methane into electricity, They include a system that flushes waste from the hog houses and uses chemicals to remove the solids. The remaining liquid then flows through tanks where bacteria removes most of the nitrogen before chemicals remove the phosphorus. Smithfield is well aware of what cleaner, more responsible technology looked like, says Hildebrand. Smithfield undertook its Smithfield Renewables Initiative a year ago, prior to the verdicts, and plans to make changes to hog operations in Utah and Missouri as well. But critics suspect the company is announcing these moves now under the pressure of the recent jury awards, one of which reached an eye-popping $94 million. If all Smithfield does is cover the lagoons, Nolan worries, that might derail public pressure on the hog industry. Right now, public sentiment is that something needs to be done to protect these communities and natural resources. And if you take half measures, it makes some people think there's an easy fix, and it's been taken care of, Nolan said. Taking half measures may, in the long run, do a lot more harm than good. We turn now to the indie food section. Bet the Farm. To create a truly sustainable food economy, small farms and government need to meet in the middle. Last year, Mike Ortoski put out a call to hundreds of Orange County farmers if they were interested in becoming certified in good agricultural practices, a U.S. Department of Agriculture designation that allows farmers to sell produce to large institutions, that the county would pay for the certifications, $1,000 price tag for each farmer. Surprisingly, only one farmer responded to Ortoski's offer. Brad Evans of Red Hawk Farm and Hurdle Mills became GIP certified this past February. I was hoping it would open up doors of who I'd sell to, Evans said, but so far he isn't using it. That sums up the struggles that Orange County, and by extension the rest of the Triangle, faces in its efforts to get more locally grown food into local institutions. For the region's food economy to thrive and to be generally sustainable, local growers need to sell their products to big buyers, like area hospitals, schools, and jails. But the cost of doing so, through GAP certification, is onerous. More importantly, local institutions currently aren't interested in buying farm area farmers, most of whom work on far too small of a scale to be useful to them. That's a problem Ortoski, who is Orange County's agricultural economic developer, and other local government officials around the Triangle are aiming to solve. Their goal is to create a large food hub where locally grown produce can be aggregated and standardized and then trucked to big buyers in the area. But this is a project that will likely take decades. What's immediately clear is that getting there will require wrestling simultaneously with two familiar economic drives, supply and demand. Around 60 years ago, North Carolina was home to farms of a range of sizes, and many owed their existence to the state's best-known cash crop, tobacco. Earning good prices, tobacco allowed small and mid-sized farms to flourish. Although this state still produces the most tobacco in the country, its popularity dropped perceptibly around the turn of the century, and North Carolina farms, especially small ones, were hit hard. Between 1954 and 2002, the USDA found that the number of NINCY tobacco farms dropped from 150,000 to 8,000. At the same time, a new trend was developing. Local, sustainably grown food began increasing in popularity in the 90s as small, diversified farms growing fruits and vegetables sprang up around the state, especially in educated, affluent regions like the Triangle. Over the past 10 or 15 years, demand for local food has really ramped up, says Ortoski. Indeed, according to the USDA, the number of farms in Orange County that sell produce directly to consumers via farmers' markets, farm stands, and consumer-supported agriculture went up by 54% between 2007 and 2012. And the amount of revenues from direct-to-consumer sales more than doubled in that time. That's echoed a national trend, according to the market research firm Pact Facts. Local food sales in the U.S. grew from $5 billion to $12 billion just between 2008 and 2014. The result is a polarized environment for agriculture in North Carolina. There are big farms that sell tobacco and corn on a national and international scale, and there are small operations that sell directly to local markets, restaurants, and individuals. Farming in the middle has disappeared, Ortofsky said. Meanwhile, many of those small farms are starting to hit a wall. According to Ortofsky and local agricultural advocates, Triangle farmer markets are leveling off in growth. The area can support only so many of them. That follows a national trend. In 2016, the USDA noted that nationally, farmers' market sales and direct subscriptions were beginning to plateau. What farmers need are new markets. The natural next step would be to look to big institutions such as schools, hospitals, and jails as potential outlets for local food. A food system with a broader base, that is, one with more area farms producing food for more local outlets. That would allow the Triangle governments to meet several important goals. Economic growth is the big one. Getting locally grown food into regional institutions would keep dollars local and have a multiplier effect, adding jobs like truck driving and food processing, and boosting growers' financial stability. Plus, it would result in fewer greenhouse gases emitted in transporting food, increased food security for the region, and probably better health outcomes for residents, concepts widely accepted by advocates of the locally grown food movement. So, why can't UNC Healthcare Hospitals get its sweet potatoes from Orange County Kate's Corner Farm, for example, rather than from a big distributor like Sodexo that might be sourcing its tubers from California? There are a couple of reasons. The first is GAP certification, which large institutions typically require of farmers who sell to them. It includes a set of standardized procedures to increase food safety and a one-day audit that can cost $1,000 a year. The process may require farmers to invest in new infrastructure or radically change their practices. The bigger issue is that GAP certification doesn't make sense for most of the area's farms. The big ones selling commodities like corn or soybeans aren't required to have it. But the small ones are currently too tiny to produce quantities of food at a level that would make it worthwhile. That's a problem of supply. But most farmers also aren't eager to become GAP certified because, so far, there's not much local demand for it. After all, given the small size of many Triangle farms, sweet potatoes destined for the UNC hospitals would have to come from a handful of places, rather than one mid-side operation. And that could mean a wide range in quality and perhaps a half dozen pickup trucks unloading at the hospital's docks daily. James Watts, merchandising manager at Weaver Street Market, says the problem affects all the region's larger buyers. For example, today I have three different farmers growing Sun Gold cherry tomatoes, one for each store because there isn't anyone who can supply all my stores, he said. That might work for a small grocery, but it wouldn't be feasible for a large institution. Indeed, UNC Healthcare said as much in a statement. They said, "We are open to exploring ways to get more local food items on our menus. The biggest challenges are the high volume that we go through on a daily basis and getting pricing that would fit into our food cost budget." End quote. What's needed, Ortofsky says, is a food hub, a central site where local produce is aggregated, processed if needed, and then distributed to institutional buyers. That way, quality could be standardized, and smaller farmers could bind their products to fill orders. That would likely make buying locally produce far more attractive to local institutions. And if that kind of new market opened, Ortofsky said, farmers will respond. Evans of Red Hawk Farm, example, is farming only about a tenth of his 52-acre property and says he could scale up if the opportunity arose. What would make the Triangle Food Hub Ortoski has in mind special would be its size. Ortoski, who's supplementing his Triangle work with a fellowship at Virginia's Wallace Center, which focuses on national efforts around food systems, believes that the final design would have to include Durham and Wake counties as well as Orange, and perhaps others, too. Regional is a sweet spot, he said. Food systems are like watershed. They're not confined to geographic boundaries. The result could be beneficial to everyone, allowing shiitake mushrooms from Wake County to combine with an order of Tucson kale from Orange County for Duke University's food services. It's big and ambitious, and exactly what the food hub would look like is very much a work in process. Ortoski and cooperative extension officials from Durham and Wake counties are meeting regularly to talk to stakeholders and map out a plan, though they still are in the very early stages. One good example is how this facility might function. Rich Small is in downtown Durham. Farmer Foodshare started out in 2009 as a gleaning operation, but has since morphed into a hub connecting regional farmers with local institutions like Durham Public Schools and the Durham County Detention Facility. Farmer Foodshare does all the logistics, picking up and delivering most of the produce and holding it in cold storage when necessary. The organization has flourished largely because of the support of the county officials. In 2009, Durham County pledged to begin buying local food from the school systems and other public institutions. Last year, it gave Farmers Food Share $20,000 to pilot a program that would bring local food into the jail. And after the county's one GAP-certified farmer ceased production last year, commissioners budgeted $50,000 to assist new farmers interested in GAP certification. Four are currently seeking that certification. There is good work being done to make Durham City and County a model food community. Heidi Carter, a county commissioner who's helped drive the focus on local food, told the Indian an email. One important step is for our local and regional food systems to be strong, and this requires ample numbers of farmers who are matched with robust markets. The kind of public support for farmers paired with mandates to bring local food into public institutions might be the key to realizing Ortoski's dream of a thriving regional food system. After all, moving it forward is a chicken or egg question. What comes first? Supply provided by farmers, or demand on the part of institutions? A government mandate that includes a specific percentage of local food to be used in public institutions could be just the jumpstart that gets the whole thing going. One way or the other, it's going to take a while. Ortoski estimates that it might be 10 years before Triangle institutions feature even 10% local ingredients. The end result, though, could be worth the wait. A triangle economy that is generally local, truly sustainable, and supports farmers at every level of their growth. Now from the indie music section, Plain Sailing. Nathan Bowles explores new dimensions of the banjo and the human psyche on Plainly Mistaken. Nathan Bowles opens his fourth LP with a refrain written by a child. "So just lie and close your eyes, listen to a lullaby," he begins on Now If You Could Remember. The song, originally composed by a 7-year-old Jessica Constable for Julie Tippett's 1976 album Sunset Glow, lends a foreboding feel to the beginning of the record. The rest of the album wrestles with this conceptual interest in self-deception, of being plainly mistaken, building through 8 more songs toward a kind of warning. Tell yourself whatever you like, and you may find yourself under a kind of cultural anesthesia. Plainly Mistaken, released in early October, is also Bowles' first album composed with a full band. The solo becomes a trio with the addition of a double bass player, Casey Toll, who worked in several local acts including Mount Moriah and cave drummer Rex McMurray. Bowles forges ahead with vocals and his beloved banjo, which have been his primary instrument since 2010. McMurray, who moved to Durham by way of Chicago in late 2015, initially met Bowles through mutual friends and, for a short spell, was taking some time off from music. "I called him one day," Bowles said, "and proposed that he re-hiatus himself." Toll, who had previously played with Bowles while accompanying the singer and guitarist Jake Zarrus-Fussell, was a natural fit. If earlier albums were marked by a kind of meandering, self-reliant drive, the texture of Toll and McMurray's seasoned playing lends Plain Mistaken a full-bodied feel. The album weaves ecstatic moments from bluegrass standards and sunny, finger-picking lopes with long, studied periods of drone. The result is something hypnotic, troubled, and deeply involved, music that's halfway between avant-garde and old-time. Bowles moved to Durham in early 2015 from Blacksburg, Virginia, where he went to college. While in Virginia, he joined ranks with the Black Twig Pickers, a string band, and Richmond's legendary drone noise outfit, Pelt. Both bands were formative to his percussive practice, as well as his deep love of old-time music. In the years since, Bowles has also toured playing drums for guitarist Steve Gunn. Bowles' many musical partnerships reflect the kind of psychedelic folk camaraderie that has evolved over the past couple of decades, comprising a thorough line of experimental folk-leaning musicians through the Triangle and the upper reaches of Virginia and up into Philadelphia. Bowles' collaborative approach to music keeps in time with the larger folk tradition of reinterpretation, and talking with Bowles is like getting a crash course in the history of that tradition. In the course of our conversation, artists ranging from Ernie Carpenter to the Osborne Brothers to Cousin Emmy all organically crop up. But even as he offers his own reinterpretation of songs, as with Tippett's Now Do You Remember, Bowles prioritizes capturing a spirit rather than offering a mimeograph. "Her voice is so specific and kind of inimitable," he said. "I was more than just trying to get something of the feeling of the song and not duplicate it. I knew as soon as I recorded it that I wanted it to start the record, to be a kind of pace-setters." Bowles' thoughtful new takes on old songs distinguish themselves throughout, Plainly Mistaken. "Ruby" is the True's take on an old bluegrass standard, hewing off from the Silver Apples as a 1968 version. Bowles' version feels at once accusatory, frenzied, and unsettling, like the wheels are about to come off at any second. His swooning rendition of Elk River Blues, written by West Virginia fiddler Early Carpenter, is a second stab at a song that has appeared on Bowles' first album, 2012's A Bottle, A Buckeye. "I've always liked that song, solo and sets, but I liked the kind of swing and heft that the trio brought it," Bowles said. "It just felt so good that I thought, why not record it? There are no rules. It swings in a different way than the solo piece." On the back of the album, a Javier Maris quote accompanies a hazy detail from a Felix Vallotton painting. "We go from deceit to deceit, and know that. In that respect, we are not deceived, and yet we always take the latest deceit for the truth." There's a kind of Gordian knottedness to this idea, in musical expression of our collectively repeated mistakes. Bowles has explored the slippery edges of language before. 2016 cover of Jeffrey Cain's Moonshine is a sunshine, gently riffed with Cain's series of wry, folksy cones. "The straightened line is crooked, and if it ain't gonna get no straighter," goes one. If the music itself, with its astral acoustic waves, which seems themselves be trying to work out some knot, reflects the idea of aphorisms, it might be that its ability to hold more than two things is in its heart, the old and the new, what is cosmic and what is rooted in the earth. There are, after all, no rules. Bowles is interested, he says, in the idea that we don't learn from mistakes as much as repeat them. Pausing, he laughs, "That probably sounds more pessimistic than it is." And now, from the Back Talk section. On Thursday, we broke the news that Hillsboro's Mystery Brewing Company and its popular brew pub would close, with the brewery having too much debt to make ends meet, following a string of bad luck. Jonathan Bonchek writes in response, "The story of North Carolina craft beer does not exist were it not for Eric Lars Myers and the Mystery team. Thank you for all you've done, not just for the beer industry, but for the whole region, in terms of appreciation of craft beverage, food, and the local independent music community." D. Ryer Anderson adds, "You can tell how much work, thought, and love they put into this project. It's true that small business requires a nimble entrepreneur. Sometimes even that is not enough. I hope the recovery from this stumble is quick and leads to someplace even better." On another subject, David Vasconis responds, "Thanks be to God for the brilliant reporting by Mrs. Hellenstein on the story of Isabel's family and her journey to seek asylum in the United States from Honduras. At this moment in history, when the most vulnerable brothers and sisters in our human family are having door after door slammed in their faces by unjust policies, irresponsible government officials, and cultural forces around the world that shut down the voices of women crying out for help, this article is a clarion call for justice. May it move us to greater compassion, solidarity, and action." And finally, in closing, a reminder that Election Day is coming up, and early voting will end on Saturday, November 3rd. Their hours are basically 7 a.m. to 6 p.m. Monday through Friday, Saturdays 9 to 6, and Sunday noon to 4. Their early voting sites: Durham, County Board of Elections, Duke University Broadhead Center, East Regional Library, North Carolina Central, North Regional Library, and the South Regional Library. Orange, County Board of Elections Office, Carrboro Town Hall, Chapel of the Cross, Seymour Senior Center, Eflin, Riverton, Clemming Center. Wake EV sites: Apex Community Center, Chavez Community Center, County Board of Elections Office, Herbert Young Community Center, Night Table Recreation Center, Lake Lynn Community Center, NSCSU Tally Student Union, Northern Regional Center, Optimus Community Center, Wake Tenor South Campus, the Physical Education Building. Well, that's about it for another week. This has been Bob Martin for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. So until next week, goodbye, good night, and good morning.